This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
Today we're going to be talking a lot about forgetting and about memory. I mustn't forget to introduce myself. My name's Dr. Leah Kaminsky. I'm a GP and I'm a writer. I've written numerous books, but I'm not the star today. We have some extraordinary panellists with us today, and I'd like to start by introducing them. I'm trying to be brief because we could spend the whole hour just going through their CVs. So we'll try and cut to the quick. Over there is Professor Ashley Bush. He's a neuroscientist and a psychiatrist, and his research involves examining the cause and treatment of Alzheimer's disease and other dementing illnesses. He's an NHMRC Australia Fellow, co-director of Biomarker Discovery for the Australian Imaging Biomarker and Lifestyle Flagship Study of Ageing. He holds an academic appointment at Massachusetts General Hospital and is the recipient of numerous awards, including the, I was told how to pronounce this, Potamkin Prize for Alzheimer's research. He's also director of the Oxidation Biology Unit, all shall be revealed, don't worry, at the Florey Institute of Neuroscience and Mental Health in Melbourne. He's the recipient of the Victoria Prize for Science and Innovation for his body of work on translational neuroscience. Dr. Ji Hyun Kim is a behavioural neuroscientist. Her work focuses on emotional learning and memory during childhood and adolescence, especially emotions related to anxiety disorders such as fear and addiction or craving. She's a senior research fellow and head of the Developmental Psychobiology Laboratory at the Florey Institute of Neuroscience and Mental Health in Melbourne. She's also a very active science communicator. You may have seen her on the telly, and she's written articles for The Conversation. She's also an impressive and vocal advocate for the role of women in science. Dr. Leonardo Rodriguez is a psychoanalyst, and memory and forgetting are a key part of his interest area. He's the founding member of the Australian Centre for Psychoanalysis and the International School of Psychoanalysis of the Forums of the Lacanian Field, all shall be revealed, and is currently the coordinator of the Institute for Training of the Australian Centre for Psychoanalysis, where he also teaches. He's been in charge of the Master of Psychoanalysis program at Victoria University. He was a senior lecturer in the Department of Psychiatry at Monash. He was trained in psychoanalysis in Buenos Aires, Paris, and Melbourne, and is the author of Psychoanalysis with Children and numerous book chapters and articles in different languages on psychoanalytic theory and practice. Quite an impressive panel, I think you'll agree. I'm just going to start with a quote by one of my... Yes. I'm going to start with a quote from one of my favourite memoirists, Danny Shapiro. Years vanish, months collapse. Time is like a tall building made of playing cards. It seems orderly until a strong gust of wind comes along and blows the whole thing skyward. Imagine it, an entire deck of cards soaring like a flock of birds. For me, memory is very closely related to perception of time, and in the same way it can be very fleeting or it can be enduring. I remember as a child you can tell how old I am from this anecdote, wanting to carve a little slot in my brain, not out of any weird sense, but I wanted to put a video cassette in there so I could record all my amazing thoughts. And I think that was the nascence of me becoming a writer. But clearly memory is not a simple recording device. And so I'd like to throw open to our panellists, just to explore how the science and the understanding of memory has developed over time and how it's evolved in the last 100 years especially. So we started with early metaphors of it being like a little filing cabinet where you store things, and then we went into the kind of weird pre-war truth serums where everything could be revealed with the right chemical. And then there was the psychology of false confessions. And now the latest emerging breakthroughs in neuroscience. So in the age of information overload, we've kind of shifted from seeing memory as the centrepiece of knowledge, where we have to just memorise things, and we place emphasis now on the importance of the pathways and the curation and retrieval of information. I think before we get on to that, I'd like to ask each of our panellists a very simple slash difficult question. Ashley, perhaps we'll start with you. Mm-hmm. From your position, what is memory?
And I'm meant to answer that just by shooting from the hip. Yep. Okay. Memory. Well, memory is what matters to a human being most.
What matters to a human being most?
Yeah. It's what defines being human. Our ability to summon the past in a way that can be described to other people, including strangers and our children. Memory is a record of past experiences that can be translated to other people.
We'll come back to you. I'm going to jump to Leonardo on responding to what your definition of memory is coming from the psychoanalytic.
Well, for me, memory is not only a theoretical matter. I've been interested in it and what psychoanalysts, others, philosophers especially, had to say on memory. But for me, it's a practical matter. And first of all, in psychoanalysis and in life, I think we have to distinguish between memory as remembering, because the English word is the same for both functions, the function of remembering and the function of preserving memory traces. Those are different things, because sometimes we know that the memory trace is there, but we cannot remember it. And sometimes we don't know why we remember what we remember. It's a bit enigmatic why we remember certain things. So memory for us is essentially unconscious. The unconscious is a theory. The theory of the unconscious is a theory of memory, in fact. And Freud changed our ways of thinking because he produced a new perspective on memory. He started with an old perspective on memory. He first believed what his patients told him. Then he questioned what he believed and what the patients told him. We know that patients tell the truth, but they also tell something else, not the truth. On the whole, they tell the truth, paradoxically, because they may think that they are lying.
It's really interesting. Gee, I'm wondering, if you could comment. I mean, you mentioned these, I guess, repressed memories. You focus a lot on children and in what is termed infantile amnesia. So can you talk to us a little bit about what is memory in children and
explain? So I'm prepared. The first time I've ever been asked what is memory was on national radio, and about 6 years ago. So that prompted me to actually really think about what memory is. And both Ashley and Leonardo are right in terms of that there's unconscious, uncontrollable element, as well as that something that definitely has to involve past and experience. So I would personally define memory as a past that becomes part of yourself. And it can be expressed not just by remembering and verbally recollecting what you've had in the past, but also just by simply reacting to certain things differently because you have experienced similar things in the past. In terms of infantile amnesia,
Can you just explain to the audience what that actually means, infantile amnesia?
Oh, so infantile amnesia is basically the simplest way of understanding is if I asked you what happened to you when you were just born or when you were one or two, it is very unlikely you remember what happened to you. But if I ask you to remember your earliest memory, it typically dates to when you're 3 or 4, or maybe a dream or some recollection someone's telling you. So it is that inability to remember things that happen to us very early in life. And it turns out that it's not because when we are 1 or 2, we can't remember what happened, but it's more that we forget very quickly when we are young. So when I'm 2, I can remember things that happened to me 1 year ago. But when I'm, 5, I can't remember what happened to me when I was 1. Whereas when I'm 15, I can remember things when I was 11. So the scientific definition of infantile amnesia is that the younger you are, the quickly you forget the things that happened to you.
And I think that, Freud has a very interesting take on that too, on the role of our memories or our consciousness as children, our pre-verbal memories as well. Do you want to just tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah.
The unconscious is a system of memories. It's not any memories, and it's not a scientific system. It's a subjective system. It stores what matters to a particular, singular, unique subject. So in that sense, memory is always fallible because it's memory from a certain perspective and it reflects only the experience of a subject. And even within that, it reflects it in a tendentious way. We know that from experience. Memory is selective at the moment of storage, at the moment of inscription, and then at the moment of remembering, of reproducing it, what arrives in consciousness. Now, I can give you a little vignette, clinical vignette. A patient told me this story. His brother was getting married, so he was asked to produce a speech in homage to his brother. So he did, as it is required in those occasions, he wrote a speech and learned it by memory, and came the moment to give the speech. He opened his mouth and he addressed to his brother, and he forgot the name of his brother. He forgot the unforgettable. He was in good health. There was no organic etiology to this accident of his memory. Now, Nietzsche had already pointed out, well before Freud, that, I can quote, it is very well put, memory says, I did that. Pride replies, I could not have done that. Eventually, memory yields. Now, the complication, say, for my patient, is that one could speculate this man hates his brother. It's easy to deduce that, but the problem is that he loves his brother. Why does he have to eliminate, in a sense, at least verbally, the existence of his brother at that crucial moment in his life? So we are interested with those things. That is, why memory fails, when at the same time, memory doesn't fail most of the time. I came here at the appointed time, for example, today. Most of the things I remember, but sometimes I forget. And when I forget, my desire, the one that I don't know, a desire that I don't want to have, an undesirable desire, plays a trick on me, and I forget. Or I remember wrongly.
What you referred to? We were out the back room starting before you, sorry. Screen memory, is that what?
Yes. Freud called it a screen memory. He coined the expression to designate those memories that appear to be good memories, but in fact their function is to cover up for memories that prefer to stay behind and not to be remembered. Screen memories. Especially in an analysis, we have many screen memories that they have typically the characteristic of being rather trivial. Sometimes they concern traumatic events, but they are not the most important traumatic events in the life of the subject. And they offer a question to the to the subject, why do I remember this at all? And he cannot find the response to it. In analysis, we can work out what it is that the memory is concealing, while at the same time showing a bit of this. Certainly, there are false memories, but on the whole, in analysis, we treat everything that the patient says as being the truth, because everything has a fragment of the truth. It is impossible
to help.
At the
risk of interrupting a psychoanalyst.
Great.
I'd like to return to your original question about what is memory. Just at this point, where I'm very happy with what Leonardo has said and what Gia has said about the dimensions of memory, but when you listen to the texture of what Leonardo is saying, the words, it's so human. It's all about the interpretation. It's all about the language that we attach to these events that occurred in the past. But what are the events that occurred in the past, really? Where do they lie? And why do we bother with them? So this is actually where I wanted to start.
And I was about to turn it over to you, so great timing.
Well, because all of that is absolutely true. And really, you're talking about the pillars of humanity and civilization. Mm. But you know where memory started? Memory started in the ability of a molecule to copy itself. So the original memory, the only memory that really makes any difference to living organisms, comes from our nucleic acids, comes from DNA and RNA. Because all of our DNA contains within it a memory of who we are. All we need is one cell of our body and the DNA content of that cell to remember our entire body and copy it, and in fact, if we wanted to clone it. So I'm glad you picked up on the human side of things, because that's my favorite side too. But really, if you want to get very technical, memory is just the chemical ability to copy something.
So I think there's a bit of a distinction here, because we're not talking about, when we talk about DNA, I don't think, well, perhaps we're not, we don't really know, talking about consciousness.
Yeah, because actually that means that you think if we can clone a human being, well, most of pop culture or science or movies would suggest that the clone doesn't have the same memory as the first original, right?
But there's a sequel to that movie.
So I agree with you in terms of sort of, I guess, evolutionary sense and biological sense that we are here because there is a memory in our DNA that knows how to make a human being. But in terms of memory, that sort of we easily experience how we ride a bike, how we recognize a loved one, I don't think there's evidence that it's actually really DNA that stores that, right?
Well, actually...
Epigenetics.
Okay. The gloves are off, G. It has now been established through a process which is called epigenetics.
Yes.
Where you can modify DNA in such a way as you can inherit the memories of your parents and grandparents. And this has been proven most commonly with mice, who we are at liberty to play with quite a bit.
This is right up my alley. I know how to answer this.
So we can we can take mice and subject them to a very strong experience of some kind, mm-hmm. which would create a tendency that didn't previously exist in them to behave one way or another. I mean, we can't exactly ask them questions like, what did you do yesterday, mousey? It doesn't happen like that.
Are you talking about the cherry blossom experiment?
I wasn't specifically thinking of that. I was thinking of something which was far more unpleasant, but it's in the category of a strong event. And that event is then presumably forgotten by that generation in the sense that they're going to go on and have progeny who weren't there when that event occurred. Then you take the progeny and you can take the progeny's progeny and you can show that the memory of the event is learnt by the subsequent generations. And this is because of permanent modifications to the DNA.
Yeah.
It doesn't create the actual recollection of the conscious event, but it's as if it had been memorized.
So actually, it's completely right. So if we look at humans, so grandparents been through a famine, It's amazing that grandchildren of those that have experienced famine in their grandparents and not even knowing it have more obsession with food and calories than grandchildren that have never experienced that in their previous ancestors. Or in the unpleasant sense, or more, I don't know what's more unpleasant than not eating, but if we have animals that have been exposed to severe you know, fearful event, like for rats, it could be a smell of cat, then their progeny, their grandchildren, actually show even more aversive reaction than those that never have been exposed in their generation. So actually, it's completely right. We definitely have this interesting, not changes in gene, but the things that control how our gene is expressed. Because if you really think about it, how our skin cell works compared to our eye cell, they're actually exactly the same DNA, but the skin cell and the eye cell or the neuron in our brain is completely different. It's because even though our DNA is immutable, it does not change. How the brain selects or how our biology selects the different components of the DNA to be expressed is always adapting, and that is actually completely under the control of what you experience, and that's what Ashley is describing.
So yeah. it's not a classic what we call Mendelian inheritance straight down, but it's more like the environmental constantly influence on the DNA. That's really interesting in the concept of collective consciousness, I guess, in a way, or what we might. Are we reducing collective consciousness down to DNA now as well? Not reducing, but
yeah, exactly.
Leonardo, what are you not reducing? Sorry, understanding. Yeah.
Look, psychoanalysis does not question, and is not opposed at all to all the findings of the neurosciences on the biochemical foundations of memory and all other human cognitive functions. But in my consulting room, I don't receive molecules.
You can see anyway with a naked eye. But.
No, I receive molecules, but in a very complex arrangement, in the form of subjects who think, suffer, and that is why they come to see me, with the purpose of getting some assistance in trying to undo what has been done, perhaps through generations, and landed on them. And the extraordinary thing is that they want assistance, but they don't want to get cured because they get some benefit from their neurosis.
Can you talk to that a little bit? Benefit from neurosis, I'd be really interested to hear about that.
Yes, it's a Pyrrhic type of benefit, as one speaks of a Pyrrhic victory, that is a great prize, a great investment, and a great loss of energy, time, and a lot of suffering is involved in the victories of neurosis. But we know for a fact that neurosis tend to prevail for quite some time, even in those who honestly embark in a process of fighting it. Because what is most intimate in them, their desires, are involved in the creation of the neurosis. The point is this: there are good reasons for memories to be fallible in the human, because, as I said, they represent unconscious desires, fundamentally. They represent unconscious desires, the prototype of which is the first foundational desire, a desire which is condemned to be prohibited, and all traces of it to be forgotten, if possible. This is the desire for the mother. This is what Freud called the Oedipus complex, which can be reinterpreted, and has been since Freud time, but there is a fundamental truth about it, which is the fact that there is this precious human being that has given life to us, that creates a bond that a whole dimension of it has to be surrendered, has to be abandoned. And this is the prototype, because from then on, all desire, all decent desire in the human is going to be contaminated with the dimension of the prohibited. And there is no desire that does not have that in the human.
Yeah, it's a relentless quest for suffering in the service of some higher goal, and the meaningless efforts that are involved in relentlessly repeating failure. That this is neuroscience. We're talking about being a neuroscientist. The neuroscientist is a neurotic. All scientists are very neurotic. We persuade ourselves that we are seeking.
We're masochistic, for sure.
Yeah, we're seeking illumination, and we hope that there is some higher ideal there. But there is a lot of suffering in it, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, that's so interesting. Oh my God, actually, I never thought. So you're totally right. I definitely approach people. My PhD is in psychology, and I have a lot of clinical psychology friends, and I've definitely studied psychoanalysis, at least in a theoretical sense, and a lot of the background from emotional memory stems from actually this unconscious control that, you know, the Freud had, this subconscious overtaking of what we choose to remember and forget. But I never thought about that in terms of my job, where a lot of neuroscientists are super neurotic, and that in a way to feel like we are justified in the things that we put in a lot of effort and emotions into, we don't let go of the higher ideal to keep pursuing, keep feeling bad about ourselves, or keep...
Leonardo, can you help us?
Yeah, actually now, look, I think...
It's not only the most neuroscientists that are neurotic. I can tell you that most psychoanalysts are neurotic.
Well,
neurosis is most of humans. It's part of the human condition. We have not found anything better as to how to conduct our desires.
And this is our love emotional.
But we are still capable of a few things which are not completely incompatible with neurosis. That's the arts, the sciences, love, hatred.
They're all pretty cool. But, you know, a lot of the time we're asked at the Florey to come up with treatments and cures, and one of the big missions that we have at the Florey has to do with the same kind of suffering as your patients who come in and say that they've been unhappy about something that torments them. And there is a condition, for example, in psychiatry called post-traumatic stress disorder, which everyone's heard about. You see something shocking, and then you have continued, repetitive, intrusive memories about this event, nightmares, anxiety. And, of course, you can try to, in the process of a therapeutic setting, you can try to undo the harm, reassure the patient, get them to disconnect from that trauma. But we're also obliged to have a look at the chemical side of things. And we spend a lot of time trying to figure out what you can do chemically to get someone to forget. And it's very interesting, you know, like if, for example, it's been proven in battlefield situations that you can get someone to forget something terribly traumatic with the right combination of drugs. So we do sometimes have to resort to reducing a problem to a molecule. And we know that, for example, a highly traumatized individual, if they're treated with the right sort of drug fast enough in the right time frame, will not consolidate the traumatic memory. And so you aid them into forgetting. Mm-hmm. I always think that actually the best approach to treating people who have been traumatized is a combination of drugs and therapy. That's not to say, I mean, psychoanalysis is wonderful when it's pure, but you have to be pretty robust to go through the whole thing. And there are a lot of people who don't have the zitzfleisch to be able to do this.
But interestingly, one of the things that we released understand is that this whole subconscious thing where similar people can go through exactly the same traumatic event, but only a fraction develop this post-traumatic stress disorder and the others don't. And fortunately, the fraction is smaller than the majority. And when we actually study these natural variations in, you know, why some people remember and some people don't, it often boils down to their early life experiences. And it turns out that when we're very young, I would define it, you know, before 7-6 years of age. So our brain, our visual perception develops actually quite slowly. Humans are what we call altricial animals, and that means that we need a lot of caretaking. We can't survive on our own as soon as we're born, as opposed to cows or guinea pigs. Like they're born, they stand up straight away, and they can actually go on eating solid food. But humans and rats and monkeys, we actually can't do that. As soon as we're born, if we don't have a caretaker, we die straight away. So we altricial species that develop way after, like, takes a while, and I'm sure you have children to know, like, while to become adults and capable.
Some more than others.
Yeah. And it turns out that if you have sort of, like, sort of chronic stress during this time, so when we're very young, we're quite robust. It turns out that even if your parents abuse you, or in the animal setting, your rodent mom abuses you, you can still form this attachment. You know, I need food, I need warmth, I need caring. So even if she's not very nice to me, I can still prefer her over a stranger. But it turns out that if you're, you know, under a prolonged stress, like not having any mum around, not having food, not having warmth, it turns out your brain develops extremely quickly, that you become a teenager when you should be a child, and that you have this ability to form memories that's extremely emotional and that it's hard to forget. Because when we're children, it turns out, because the brain's a bit different, we forget much quicker. But if you have this chronic stress or some aversive event, that you don't remember as much.
And you've done some research into neurotransmitters in children. Mm. Can you speak a little bit about, is that relevant to?
So basically, before 7 years of age, your brain's completely different. Like Ashley said, we have a lot of molecules that are happening, and our brain's actually always changing, to be honest. So it's only about 30 years ago that people even believed that we had new neurons born. Now it's like common knowledge. As soon as you're born, you continuously produce these new neurons. Your neurons are continuously making these new
neurons
connections.
Neurons as in nerve cells.
Yeah, nerve cells, cells in the brain, basically. But before, even 30, 40 years ago, people thought that that was stupid. People thought that as soon as you're born, that your neurons stop dividing. You have all you have as a baby is all you have left with, so that if you bang your head, that's it. You've damaged your neurons. And then that actually, some horoscope astrologers believe that that's why when you're born really mattered in terms of your personality, because that's when your brain stops making new cells. But that's not true at all. So our brain continues to develop, and that means that the neurotransmitter level, so the molecules that that allows the cells to communicate. For example, oxytocin is really well known for increasing bonding, increasing trust. If you have this oxytocin, you know, you sniff it, because people use it a lot at childbirth to stop bleeding. If you sniff oxytocin and look at a stranger's face, somehow people rate that person as more trustworthy. And those chemicals vary greatly depending on our lifetime, because depending on when we are, so when we are babies, we really need to bond with parents. But when we're the teenagers, the best thing for our genes is to have sex. So we have oxytocin for strangers, for example. You know, the more sex you have with a variety of people, you know, that matters. So neurotransmitters continuously change throughout our lifetime, and that really affects our memory.
Oxytocin is a secret ingredient in a certain form of aftershave.
Really?
I thought it was in chocolate. Isn't it in chocolate? Mm? Isn't it in chocolate?
They have talked about it. Put it into chocolate.
That would be a problem.
No, it's dopamine.
Fun facts, guys.
Dopamine that is in chocolate.
Oh, that's
makes
right.
Us okay. Really happy.
Well, while you're on the subject of the chemistry again, I don't want to leave without telling you the story of Eric Kandel. Mm. So, Eric Kandel is a psychoanalyst. He's still alive. He's at Columbia University, and he actually grew up in the same suburb as Freud. So obviously he was a kid. And he went on to do training in psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. And he won the Nobel Prize in the year 2000 for discovering the molecular basis of memory. And he was a psychoanalyst. His motivation was to figure out what is memory. And it's a remarkable story how he did this. And I'm not going to tell the whole thing now because we've only got a limited amount of time. But I'll tell you one thing about how he did it. He deduced the following. He said, memory is universal amongst all living things. I'm going to take the simplest organism I can find with the simplest brain I can find, and I'm going to understand its memories from beginning to end. And the organism he studied was the sea snail. It's a Californian mollusk. It looks like a big snail, and it's got eyes and a siphon which it breathes through. And the interesting thing about this animal is that you can studied in the lab. They were cheap. I mean, people were eating them. So he'd just say, I want mine very fresh. And he would put the animal in his lab. This is in the early 50s. And he would touch its siphon, which is like an animal's gills. And when he touched the siphon, the animal would withdraw this thing. Imagine touching an animal's eye. And in fact, you could try it on your own eye. If you take your eye and you poke your finger in it, you blink, right? But if you do it gently enough and do it repeatedly, eventually you stop blinking. This is actually also a test for Parkinson's disease. People can't stop blinking when you tap them in the middle of the forehead. Most people will stop after you continue to tap them. It's called extinction. The animal has concluded that whatever the repetitive stimulus is, it forgets it. I'm sorry.
Extinction. It's habituation. Sorry.
Habituation. Yes. Thank you.
Extinction is learned. Habituation is like random, like, you know, no learning occurring, just repeated.
Oh, I'm sorry. Don't tell Jeff Donnan. I'm sorry. I was away that day. Anyway, so
you see what happens in secret laboratories.
Yeah, anyway, you get what I mean. The animal stops reacting and it has developed a memory. And what Eric Kandel did was he said, okay, let's find this memory. So he dissected open the animal's head. It doesn't really need its head in order to live. And it goes into its brain. And this all while he's looking under big goggles. And the neurons are actually visible. He can see them. They're so big. And there are only six of them there. And he figures out what the connections are between them. He works out that it's either electricity or chemistry. And what he did was he read the literature. To cut a long story short, he put a chemical on top of those neurons to prove that it was a chemical communication between them. So he could fool the animal into the memory. And through this process, he figured out it's a chemical event. And then he even went so far as to inject every individual nerve cell with the chemicals that are involved to change the outcomes in terms of the animal's ability to memorize something as simple as something is touching me that's harmless, I need not bother responding to it. Now, that's how the original memory pathway was decided in the 50s, and 45 years later, he won the Nobel Prize for that. And most of psychiatry and an enormous amount of neuroscience works off that platform. So what G is talking about
is a snail.
Yes.
It's the same thing that happens in the human. It's just that was the snail's got six neurons. We've got, what, 100 billion?
Yeah.
100 billion with more combinations between them than there are stars in the universe. And it's through this myriad of combinations and permutations that we get our ability to have this fantastic function, which is called being human.
Literally, Kandel had about 300 publications understanding the chemicals and molecules and electricity on how memories are formed, and he has about two on how we forget. And that's where it ends. That's why it's interesting, because people ask me so much about what's forgetting, and I'm like, you know what, there's only about like three of us doing that in the world right now, understanding what's biological about forgetting.
He was in Melbourne. I asked him, what do you think is the unconscious? And he said, it's cyclic AMP. Anyway, that's
molecules. Yeah. What did Freud and him get on together? They were neighbours?
They didn't know each other.
Freud would be much older than Eric.
Okay. Of course, that timing. Okay, I forgot. I just want to ask you...
Eric is still alive.
So that answers my question. I was about to say, do animals have memory? Do they have the same sort of memory as we do, Leonardo? Could you psychoanalyze my cat, please?
No.
I'm sure you can.
I don't think so.
Cats.
He needs it.
It's been said, we know, Freud gave it the name of transference to a phenomenon that occurs in psychoanalysis and in other clinical situations in which the patient falls in love some way or other, or develops a very special relationship with the healer, in our case with the psychoanalyst. But as one famous psychoanalyst put it, he had a dog that he took everywhere.
The psychoanalyst had the dog.
The psychoanalyst had the dog, and he said to his audience, this dog, by the name of Justine, she loves me, but she has no transference with me. She doesn't have a transference with me because she does not confuse me with anyone else. In the case of psychoanalysis and other professions in which this transference relation, which is a kind of hypnotic relation, occurs, the healer, in our case the psychoanalyst, is put in the place of somebody who has been significant in the life of the patient. This happens unbeknownst to the patient. It happens unconsciously, but it does happen. And everybody has the experience of that in ordinary life to an extent. Somebody has a row with his boss at work, comes home and continues the row with a poor woman who happens to be his wife, who is not his boss at all, but he has transferred his problem with his boss to his wife. There is another way of dealing with the matter. He could come and tell the story to the wife, which is what we expect in psychoanalysis happens. Mm-hmm. But we get quite a bit of the first kind, too.
Do you think a dog has got an unconscious?
No.
Oh, really?
But hang on, maybe it's just that we haven't discovered the molecules.
The term unconscious is not that good, because it's a negative term. It's a negative term. If you say unwhite, that covers a reality which can include any color.
Does a dog have a conscious?
Yes. Okay. Yes, but not an unconscious, because he's not a being of language. He doesn't speak. The unconscious, the human unconscious, is an effect of our being speaking beings.
But no, doesn't a dog? But a dog has got defenses, and I can prove this to you. Because when you train a dog, you interject.
Precisely. If you have an unconscious, you're going to have defenses.
Yeah.
If you have an unconscious, it's because there is something you don't want to know, but you do know anyway.
No,
the dog does not have that conflict.
I think that, I don't think unconscious has to necessarily involve like conflict between what we want to be aware or not aware. I think unconscious things can definitely involve things that happen without, beyond your control. And most of the ways, including the aplysia from Eric Kendall's study with the sea snails, I don't think they made a conscious decision to remember or blink or, you know, withdraw their reflexes. The very reason why we call associative learning, like if I see a light, then it's going to be bright, is called conditioned reflexes, is the fact that its reflexes are beyond our control. And I think most of animals actually learn by unconscious ways. You know, they respond and jump, not without making a decision. For example, when my animals stop being afraid because it's early in their life and all these neurotransmitters and all these brain regions are underdeveloped, so that if I teach them to be afraid and then I teach them that this is no longer something threatening and they never am afraid again, they never are afraid of that threatening thing ever again because I teach them not to be, because they're young and they're neurotransmitter underdeveloped. I don't think these animals are making a conscious decision that this thing is not threatening anymore. I think it's a complete reflex that they think, okay, well, this is no longer harmful. Just like the aplysia, like these puffs are not really harmful, so I'm not going to blink anymore.
We are using the term unconscious in different ways.
Yeah, yeah.
The psychoanalytic.
I kind of feel like I'm in the middle of an Escher print at the moment, and we're going to be running out of time. So there's. I want to throw it open to the audience fairly soon, but there's something that I really would like to ask Ashley about, if I may, and that's your current research. I have a hidden agenda here, and I must confess that I would really love to turn all of you vegan, but take it away, Ashley.
Okay. Well, so I have spent a long time researching Alzheimer's disease, which is a terrifying illness where you forget your own life. And I can go into a lot of technical detail about it. And it has been a subject which has been of interest to the research community in Melbourne for a long time, because the person who first purified the protein that accumulates in the brain in Alzheimer's disease, Colin Masters, was the professor of psychiatry of pathology in Melbourne, and he's still an active member of our Florey Institute. And his legacy is to have trained a lot of Alzheimer's researchers. So we've got a lot of know-how in Melbourne. And over the years, it's turned out to be a very frustrating thing to try to come up with either the cause or the treatment for. We have symptomatic treatment, but we don't have anything to stop the erosion of the brain that occurs. It's not natural aging. It's an awful disease. And our particular work, the work I'm involved with, has to do with a discovery about something completely new in terms of the chemistry of the brain with aging. That has to do with the accumulation of iron in the brain. Over the last few years, we've been publishing quite a bit about this, and this is a feature of natural aging that gets out of control in Alzheimer's disease. And it feeds into the collection of the protein that Colin Masters described, the amyloid protein, and it seems to make it more combustible. So we're going to commence a clinical trial later this year, which is the first time that a treatment that captures the excess iron in the brain is going to be tested to see whether it can control Alzheimer's disease and stop the deterioration from occurring. And you're right, being a vegetarian or a vegan seems to have advantages for your health. This is well understood for a variety of conditions. And it's possible, but hasn't been proven, that people who are not vegetarian accumulate iron at a faster rate, and that might affect their liability to develop a condition like Alzheimer's disease. That's what you were interested in, but that's not... I'm agnostic about that. I personally am vegetarian.
You have steak? No.
I don't eat steak, no. I keep away from iron, and I can tell you a lot about why it's reasonable not to have too much meat as you get older.
I think I'm going to give a little bit more time than we normally do to the audience, because I'm sure there are some people out there who are just chomping at the bit to ask our esteemed panel some questions. There's a lady up the front here.
Could I ask about global amnesia then? If where does that fit in where you're discussing consciousness and memory?
Global amnesia. Who wants to...
Have you known someone to have global amnesia?
I had it, so I was just really interested.
Are you better?
Yeah.
Do you want to tell us what happened?
I was under a lot of stress with my husband, who was very ill with dementia, and I left him in a hospital. I drove a couple of miles. I remember being there, and then I woke up at home asking, where is my husband? And that went on in a repetitive fashion, and they took me off to hospital. And then I had a bad headache, and so I had my memory again, and a year later it happened again.
So global amnesia is usually has a trigger, so it has to be some extreme stress or physical trauma. So if you think about our brain always sort of talking to each other, all these different things like so where we see, where we smell, where we hear, all talking to each other, and they're sort of forming this like stable memory in some components. And extreme stress, and which has a hormonal reaction really, can actually hijack that system. So it is not surprising if you have extreme stress or car accident, something extremely traumatic, your brain just sort of stops all of that constant communication, paying attention to things that, you know, it's actually very common then that you have forgetting just around that period of time, usually what we call retrograde. So around the time you can't remember the previous events around that time. Like if you fall off a chairlift, for example, my brother had a really severe global amnesia where he kept calling me saying, gee, did I tell you to pick you up? I'm like, yes, this is the 8th time you call me. And so, yeah, that's what happens. But usually it's restorable, right? Yeah.
Yes, and it could be used to protect the individual from being overwhelmed by the trauma. And I'm sure that that's true in psychoanalysis as well.
Yeah, I'd like to hear your take on that, Leonardo.
Well, as a psychoanalyst, I cannot speculate on the diagnosis of a condition that could be due to the workings of the unconscious, but not necessarily. The unconscious is opportunistic and take advantage of anything in a person's life that offers the opportunity to express a desire. And amnesia is one such opportunity. But I wouldn't say that in the case of this or that person, this is the case. That is this the work of the unconscious that has taken place. I would need to listen more to see all the associations, all the connections that may emerge, which are impossible to predict for any given patient.
And neuroscientists, are there any studies? I mean, you can have to just pick it up like that, but anything in terms of looking at the chemistry, the molecules in a situation of global amnesia, is there any correlation with the change in...
Well, as G said, there's a lot of chemistry going on that protects the brain in a traumatic event. But perhaps one of the most interesting scenarios that a lot of people can relate to is the trauma of childbirth, because a lot of mothers will say that their recollection of the labour is not as vivid as those who have witnessed it.
Thankfully, yeah. Sometimes,
so
yes.
Labour not only releases a lot of oxytocin, but releases a huge amount of opioids. So basically natural morphine and heroin inside your system that, you know, and heroin, morphine really, really has huge amnesic properties. So that, you know, especially I'm actually lactating, you know, breastfeeding actually releases a lot of opioids as well. It just naturally inside your brain and they make you forget.
So there really is such a thing called baby brain.
But you know, like global amnesia is super uncommon. If you get smashed by drinking alcohol and you don't remember that night, that is because alcohol increases, you know, GABA and aminobutyric acids, which is a natural amnesic in your brain. So there are a host of known chemicals and hormones that are released because that makes us forget.
Mm. While we're on the subject of alcohol, you know, drinking actually is a little bit protective against Alzheimer's disease. I like to tell the story.
Not just red either. I read any drinking, really.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Well, cheers.
Can we put a little proviso in there, just, you know, medico-legally?
But it doesn't have to be red. Like, drinkers tend to have better memory later on in life than non-drinkers. So just a little bit, you know. Yeah.
It's healthy. Yeah. But in moderation.
He's got the bottle down there, guys.
Yeah.
We might open that up to another question. The roving mics are choosing.
My question is there a particular part of the brain that controls a short-term memory? And if a hypoxic incident causes damage to the base of the brain, and obviously I think it causes some difficulties with short-term memory, can a person be trained when that part of their brain is injured to learn new things?
Just to explain, hypoxic meaning lack of oxygen, an incident where there's lack of oxygen temporarily to the brain.
You know, hippocampus, so sort of like bit maybe 5-6 centimetres in from here, they'd like, you know, sort of curve like goat's horn.
It's from the Icelandic word for dragon, the keeper of memory.
Yeah, and part of hippocampus is called cornea ammonis, so it means goat's horn. So anyway, this little curled up region is very important for short-term memory. And that's the region that produces the most new neurons, as I described, after we're born. So that's like the big region of neurogenesis. What that means is that that area of the hippocampus is the most affected by what we do, whether we exercise, whether we are depressed, whatever environment we're in. And that part is extremely important for short-term memory as well as forming long-term memory. And so it's good because that is very plastic until we die. And we know that exercise is very good for it, keeping that neuron or keeping that region healthy and big. So, you know, even if you have hypoxia and maybe that area has suffered some. So when you're chronically depressed, which means that you're not very stimulated because you're not doing much and you don't want to feel much and you don't want to go out to work, that area tend to decrease over time in depressed patients over non-depressed patients. But that area can also increase the most if you exercise or if you stimulate yourself or if you put yourself in social interaction, in interactive situations where you're stimulated. So yes, there are ways that you can, you know, help to mitigate damages done because our brain is plastic. And I think it's actually very optimistic compared to 100 years ago when we thought that our brain was stable, and if you damage it, that was it. But now we know our brain is changing, and especially the parts that that forms short-term and long-term memory.
And that's the part of the brain that gets destroyed in Alzheimer's disease.
Yeah, a lot.
And when that goes, you've lost short-term memory. So you can't record things anymore, but you can remember what's already been recorded. So that part of the brain, the hippocampus, is not the part of the brain where the memory is stored long-term. It's distributed to different parts of the brain.
Mm. Actually, I want to ask you, I mean, we've all sort of, you know, some of us have been guilty of watching videos on Facebook late into the night where there's extraordinary, you know, elderly people who are completely shut down with Alzheimer's. Someone will wander in and give them a piano and they'll start playing things, you know, concert pianos from the past. How does that work at the molecular basis?
Well, the memory resides in other parts of the brain. Mm. So in Alzheimer's disease, it's mainly the hippocampus, the short-term recording apparatus, that is damaged. The other parts of the brain are relatively spared, although they eventually die too. But because the hippocampus goes first and that short-term memory ability to record stops, the tapes are still there. So you can summon the tape back. The question is, what do you do to summon the tape back? And very often it's a matter of finding the right cue. And cues, in terms of the maps of the brain, don't necessarily go through the hippocampus, which is damaged in Alzheimer's disease. Other parts of the brain are summoned to help it along. So, for example, there's a famous book by Marcel Proust called A la recherche de temps perdu, where he describes a stimulus that is a smell, and the smell engenders a memory. And that's the kind of connection that we're talking about.
The Madeleines.
Yeah, that's right.
Not the search of lost time. So in terms of like playing a piano is what we say is more like a procedural memory, like a riding a bike or swimming. It's sort of like muscle memory and we don't really have to think deeply about it. And those memories are actually typically not dependent on the hippocampus and more other parts of the brain that are spared from Alzheimer's.
I was having a conversation with a friend recently about smell and memory and explaining how certain smells brought back memories very vividly, even bad smells, if you like bus fumes reminded me of being in the Mediterranean on holiday, or photographic chemical smells reminded me of my early work life, which I enjoyed. So what I'm asking is why...
We're running out of time, so I don't mean to be rude, but
why is it that memories are brought back so sharply at times by smell? A smell you mightn't have encountered for 30 years, for example.
I'd really be interested to hear the psychoanalytic theory of that. We've heard the sort of molecular one.
I don't think there is a response that covers all cases, but certainly it has figured prominently in many screen memories. That is, memories that apparently are relatively innocent all by themselves, but it is their connections that matter, and it is their connections that the person wants to forget. So there is a tension there between what is remembered and what is forgotten. Forgetting is not exactly the opposite of memory. It's a memory kept in reserve, a memory not to be remembered, not a memory that is extinguished.
Yeah, we did promise to talk about forgetting. So go ahead, Jen.
Well, back on smelling, when you think about it, if you think about species that are, you know, less complex like humans, they rely a lot on smelling. And it's almost like the most sort of very animal and basal part of us. So if you want to touch your brain, hope not, you can actually stick up your finger up your nose, and our olfactory bulb that deals with smelling is actually the brain that is the most external and exposed to the outside world. And so it is not surprising then that smell has such a powerful control over and above our decision-making, our executive function that makes us human, that makes us inhibit our control, that is something very animalistic about smell that is directly exposed to the outside and directly connected to the places that form our memory. So it is actually really, really common that people remember smell and they can't control what they remember from smell.
Well, if I could talk about one of our discoveries at the Florey Institute, there are two parts of the brain called the amygdala, which are responsible for fight and flight. That is to say, you take any primitive organism, scare it, it will just make a decision whether to run away or fight. And the nerves for smell plug straight into those parts of the brain. And it's, as G says, this is part of evolution, that as we evolved, the most important sense to begin with was smell, because it could tell you whether there was a toxin there or a predator or
something,
a mate.
Something to eat or not. Yeah,
yeah, something to eat. Mm. So it's the priority in terms of the development of the brain was to plug into the fight or flight centre. Then came eyes. Eyes are very... It's another part of the brain. Altogether.
Eyes are a very human part of cognition, actually, here.
I think we have time for one more question, and please do make it a brief question.
Why does my 92-year-old mother, she can remember everything about my brother's new girlfriend, all the details, like just a few days ago, but can't remember that she's asked the same question of me 7 or 8 times in the last 5 minutes?
What was the question?
Just a simple, you know, have we had dinner or, you know, have you, did you go to work
today?
We're
going to need a quick answer to that one. I'm getting the wind-up signal.
The girlfriend's more interesting.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Like she's very interested in the girlfriend because it's novel, it's new, but like whether you had dinner or not, like she cares that you're not hungry, but then it's a very mundane everyday question.
And I don't think I really want to open that up to psychoanalysis at this stage.
Yeah, are you the first child or the second child?
The only thing a psychoanalyst can say is that you can ask your mother that she tells the rest of the story and like her preference.
I think we'll leave it at that point. I really want to thank our panellists, Ashley, G and Leonardo, for their unique perspectives on forgetting and memory. And thank you so much to the Wheeler Centre and to all of you.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.